Hello, welcome to this little workshop I got the opportunity to organize. I will now just say a few words to introduce the structure of the workshop. It's supposed to be something which we discuss a lot. There's a long slots for talks, and the speakers don't have to fill them up. We are supposed to engage and interact a lot. So I'll start with giving this introduction, and then there will be the first talk by Andrea, one of our young students. And let's see. I will start with just saying a few words about what shape dynamics is, so that some of you don't work in the field, some of you just heard about it, some even don't. So I'll just summarize the basic, so you can enjoy the rest. So this is a quite grand statement. I'm kind of regretting writing it, but yeah, yeah. That's just to convey the idea. Hello, that there's a lot of conceptual ideas behind shape dynamics, and it condensed into a physical theory only recently. But people have been thinking about these things regarding relationalism, space, and time for a long time. Here, I just want to show you a couple of quotes that I think are really important for the history of shape dynamics. This is Paul Dirac in 63, was writing in a newspaper. And this statement apparently made a huge impression on Julian, here present, in that it's the one of the few cases in which a really important physicist, someone who's respected, not a crackpot, put in doubt the usefulness of space-time, of four-dimensional Lorentzian manifolds for physics, or their unquestioned fundamental importance. He says that his studies, he was working on what was he working on? Quantization and trying to fix the coordinates.
Canonical form of general relativity.
Yeah,
and parallel with the ADM problem.
Exactly,
that, started coming up in 59, and I think he was a bit earlier. But
it's the paper on the fixation of coordinates, I think, right?
That was comes in his 59 paper.
Okay.
And then that's the Scientific American from May 1963.
You can find the whole article on Scientific American, actually. It's online. It's free access. They reprinted it like twice, I think. And it's just saying that a few decades ago, it seemed quite certain that one had to express the whole physics in 4D form. I would say that it's still valid, that this is still true today, largely. But now it seems that 4D symmetry is not of such overriding importance.
But look, you're faced with electromagnetism. Boring as hell. You never write it in 4D form, ever, ever. You write down E's and B's and you just
yeah.
know.
Yes, that's what you do.
You know, it's just,
but if you do, you are kind of surprised that it all works so compactly.
Why are you surprised?
I was in my EM classes.
Maybe I've been doing it off long enough, but somehow you just look at what you do with electromagnetism and do it with GR and you get 3+1.
Fair enough. Yeah, so anyway, this Julian in his book says that this made a huge impression on him, and it's an important part of shape dynamics. We're not considering space-time as fundamental. That is our first input. This other one, this is a sentence by Jimmy York in 72 in one of his important papers on the solution to the initial value problem of GR. And this made a huge impression, at least on me. I don't know about you guys, but he's saying that, I will tell you about this, but his method allows to reformulate the dynamics of GR as a time-dependent geometry of shape. I will make this precise. He calls them transverse modes. Pay attention to the plural. Interacting with the changing scale of space, longitudinal mode, and this is singular. There is just one mode that has to do with shape, with scale in his treatment, and the rest is all shapes. The local degrees of freedom are only conformal invariant degrees of freedom, as you will see. And I think, well, many people have been thinking about this, and this Kale mode is quite different from the rest. I believe that Neil here present and Julian and other people have been have realized that its character is quite different, and it has more to do with time, with a time variable, than actually playing the role of a dynamical degree of freedom, two Hamiltonian degrees of freedom that interact with the rest. I will be more precise soon.
Exactly.
Yes.
Maybe I can make an interesting point for the first quote, because I've read this paper from Dirac, and he was, like Julian said, he's setting up the Hamiltonian formalism of GR, and he makes this change that's not four-dimensionally covariant, and it simplifies his primary constraints in his theory hugely, and I think that's why what led him to make this comment. Mm-hmm. So his kind of formalism came a lot simpler when he made this change, which was clearly non.
Yes,
not
which was clearly non-covariant.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So he says the description of nature sometimes gets simplified, and I mean, a paradigm like space-time is useful to the extent that it makes life easier,
mm-hmm.
and one shouldn't keep it as sacred, not necessarily. So let's see. Thank you for the comment. If you want to hear, read more in detail about shape dynamics, let me shamelessly advertise this upcoming book with Oxford. And you should all buy a copy. I'll give you your money back, don't worry. I'll refund you personally. I don't know, they said 8 months or something like that.
Oh,
yeah, so it was quite a shock for a millennial like me. Someone who's used to have things coming out like every month or so. But yeah, this is a book too. Okay, so principles. This is a philosophical part I was referring to, but I'm trying to make it more precise now. We assume a spatial relationalism, and of course you all familiar with diffeomorphisms, I hope. They refer to the possibility of changing your coordinates, of putting labels at each point in your manifold in different ways. And this is clearly a relational property of GR, of every theory that has this symmetry or gauge invariant. Hello, gauge redundancy. You can get the program there. But we're adding this. We're trying to push relational ideas to the bitter end. We are adding 3D wild invariants, so the ability to change your local notion of scale in a three-dimensional manifold. You can't do that in a you can, but you won't get a theory that is equivalent to GR if you insist on four-dimensional wild invariants. So this is an important point for shape dynamics. And also, these are geometrical redundancies. They are in a very well-defined sense. They lead to a configuration space, a reduced configuration space after you quotient these symmetries. That has good properties, while the symmetries of general relativity in its Hamiltonian form don't, and it's an important point for us. The other aspect is temporal relationalism. Here, I'm referring to the fact that when you refer to change to some time that elapsed, you have to compare clocks in some sense. You have to say, this degree of freedom changed that much in the time that this other degree of freedom changed by this other amount. Of course, this subsumes a notion of simultaneity, which is very known covariant in the GR sense. The precise mathematical statement is that you consider physical only a curve in a reduced configuration space, and its parametrization is not relevant, or can simplify the description, but it doesn't have to be part of your degrees of freedom. So you're just comparing the relative state of things at each point, and that's how you can say that time passed. Now, if you assume these things, you will be led to reject space-time as a fundamental object, but of course it's still hugely useful. In shape dynamics, it is an emergent concept, and it's a simplification that applies to the dynamics of some degrees of freedom, the light ones, the ones that are not back-reacting, whose back-reaction can be ignored, what Einstein called probes, I think. So if you do this, your fundamental requirement won't be that you want a regular space-time manifold. You're assuming a three-dimensional conformal geometry, and you want that to be regular. And this can lead to departures from GR. This is why what we are investigating at the moment and why we think it's interesting. A bit of evidence in favor of this point of view is the fact that the notion of simultaneity we are employing has good properties in the sense that it avoids singularities, some kind of singularities of GR. And therefore, if in general relativity you insist on regularity of your space-time manifold, you will soon find that it's impossible to hold. This condition will fail somewhere because there are singularities in GR. This theory we are studying seems to not like them, and the requirement of regular conformal three geometry can be preserved. So you will hear a lot about that by these three young students. Yes.
The problem with space-time regularity in GR is that there are all these creepy, not really singular things, but which people insist on calling singularities. Say, you know, very weak forms of singularity come in, which really shouldn't disturb us, but do somehow. Is it that sort of singularity that the conformal geometry avoids, or what kind of singularity? Is there any particular classification of the singularities that avoids? If you look at the singularity theorems, they have a very weak definition of what is a singularity.
It's non-extendability of.
Sometimes it's just a situation where even the situation focusing. Where two geodesics cross. Mm. Caustics. All sorts of things are regarded as singularities in the singularity theorems.
Penrose's singularity theorems actually show that no geodesics are not extendable, right? It does use the focusing theorem which forms caustics.
I always feel that somehow there are things which are regarded as singularities which a sensible person mightn't.
Can I just say, following up, I think that one of the real things we should do in shape dynamics in the coming years is really see, like Hercules cleared out the Augean stables. I think there's a whole lot of mishmash and stuff in the space-time picture that's come from these very weak assumptions that underlie the singularity theorems. And in particular, if you say that scale is a gauge degree of freedom and you're only concerned with the conformal degrees of freedom, and we have a clean notion of simultaneity, I think we could do a lot of work in saying, look, this is a much cleaner picture. But I think there's a lot of work.
On the other hand, there is also the possibility of the appearance of shape singularities.
Oh, yes, that we can't avoid.
That is something we'll have to face and see what happens.
I don't think we've done, at least we haven't published much work on singularity theorems yet, but certainly I think just to respond to your question, the singularities that we don't see are the curvature singularities in short shape.
Okay,
And curve and everything. Those are real. And I think that, at least the insight that we have is that in these maximal slice equations, you just don't have, if the singularity, curvature singularity comes from the conformal factor of the metric.
Yeah.
Or the lapse.
Yes.
In maximum slicing or CMC gauge.
Yes.
Then we can say in shape dynamics it's just not there.
Yeah. Okay.
I can make a point here because maximum slicings, they don't necessarily have to avoid the curvature singularities. It's more correct to say they avoid three spaces of vanishing volume. Because I think in the rise and Nordstrom solution or something, a maximal slicing avoids a certain free space that's not the curvature singularity. So it doesn't have to be the curvature singularity that the maximal slice is avoided. It's more correct, but it was a paper from your student.
that. It's a volume singularity,
yeah,
what you call
a volume
a crushing singularity. Okay. Yeah, well, so we still need to sort these things out properly and have a classification. Let's work for the future. Okay, where was I? So for those of you who are completely unaware of the thing, shape dynamics is just based on taking seriously a message from this corpus of work from the 60s, the 70s, even before with Liknarovich. These people formulated GR in its Hamiltonian formulation, and one can be motivated by wanting to quantize the theory, but even at the classical level, I would say, if you want to sort out what the physical degrees of freedom as opposed to gauge are, you should switch from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian description. Now, Hamiltonian description is based on a preferred notion of time, so you just slice somehow your space-time, and your metric will decompose into a spatial metric, a three-dimensional metric, a vector called shift, and a scalar function called lapse. And this was work by Arnowitz, Deser, and Misner in the 60s. And you find out that the Einstein action can be written as a symplectic term plus a linear combination of constraints, and the shift and the lapse functions don't appear with their time derivatives, therefore they are Lagrange multipliers. They're not physical degrees of freedom. And if you vary with respect to them, you will get these two constraints. This should be D, by the way. Yeah, D is the what we call the three-dimensional diffeomorphism constraint. It's just stating that the momentum conjugate to the three metrics should be transverse with respect to the three metrics, much like electromagnetism, where you have transverse modes. The Hamiltonian constraint is the other one, the one you get when you vary with respect to the lapse. It's more complicated, and it doesn't admit a straightforward geometrical interpretation as D, because it's not linear in the momenta. Well, this basically acts like a vector field on some configuration space. This guy here is, as Julian likes to put it, is an admixture of dynamics and gauge, and it's hard to disentangle which is which. So this issue, yes? No, I didn't, because this is a short introduction. you should have boundary terms and
the poking.
Yes, this for no reason.
Yeah. The way the boundary terms, if you have a spatially closed universe, which in my opinion is really the place where the shape dynamics comes into play, I think boundary conditions, that asymptotically.
Yes, but you have a bunch
not
of them.
The shape dynamics.
That's what I wanted to say.
Right. okay, just quickly. In the 70s, these guys, York, Shuki, Brouwer, and, Liknarovich was from the, and Neil.
Neil proved the existence and uniqueness of the solution via microwave.
Yeah,
that's right.
That was
right. which year was that?
72.
So, it's, yeah. Liknarovich is 49, something,
that's
much
that's
before,
right.
So yeah, it's not really from the 70s, but
no.
It spans a whole bunch of decades. And these people, last but not least, Neil, worked on trying to solve the initial value problem, as you say, of GR. So it means that you choose a Cauchy surface and you want to find initial momenta and metrics that solve this and this constraint. And this is by no means straightforward. And what they found is that there is a particular condition that you can impose that amounts to really fixing the kind of foliation, the way you slice space and time. And it has to do with the trace of the momentum conjugate to the metric being a spatial constant. So, well, it's a density, so you have to have this volume form, but it's the same everywhere. Now, the momentum is related to the extrinsic curvature of your space-time, or your space-like manifold, as it is embedded in space-time. Therefore, its trace measures how much this spatial surface, hypersurface, expands at each point. And this just means that the expansion is constant everywhere, and it's an average value. In this particular gauge, if you want, in this
expansion as in the expansion of congruences. So, to think about this.
co-moving congruences of co-moving observers. But mathematically, it's literally the, how much the scale factor in the metric changes. When it's zero, it stays the same, and you have either a throat or a recollapse. In this foliation, these two constraints decouple. They become independent from each other, and you can solve them independently. And they turn into elliptic equations. And elliptic equations, as you can read in Neil's thesis, they have very nice properties of existence and uniqueness. And moreover, these properties are really, you make full use of them only in closed space, right? Because you don't have boundary conditions that are somewhat arbitrary. You don't have to specify them. They're given to you by the topology of your spatial manifold. So in closed space, a solution of GR will be specified by let me explain this, but it will be specified by a momentum that satisfies this condition and the transverseness condition and a metric which is any element of an equivalence class. And this equivalence class is given by these two transformations here. This, as I showed you, is a diffeomorphism constraint, so it generates changes of coordinates. This now, if you work out the maths, you can see that it acts on through Poisson brackets on your metric. In this way, it changes its conformal factor. So this is the generator of wild transformations, three-dimensional wild transformations. So a momentum that is both transverse, satisfying this constraint, and traceless, satisfying this other constraint that they imposed, so we call this TT momentum, will generate changes of neither coordinates nor scale. What is left is shape. So equivalence classes of three metrics under conformal transformations and diffeos, conformal geometries. And you will find a solution of the initial value problem if you specify a minimal amount of data. This minimal amount is a three-dimensional conformal geometry, so any representative in that equivalence class, they will all give the same solution. It's a symmetric transverse traceless tensor, so the momentum conjugate to change of shape, plus one number, which is called York time, or, well, we can have CMC time, whatever. It's this average factor that the trace of the momenta is proportional to. To recap, the message from the 70s that we want to take at heart and take seriously and push to the ultimate consequences is the fact that really the physical degrees of freedom of GR, the minimal degrees of freedom that you need to specify to have a physical equivalent solution are conformal geometries and their conjugate momenta. So one note is that this thing of singularity avoidance, we had already quite a discussion, but there's, just for you, Neil, there's this reference already. I don't know if you know that, Marzen and Tipler. Yeah, they discuss somewhat what kind of singularities can be avoided by taking trace P equals zero. And I think in the CMC case, I think essentially you get the same results with the difference that the volume can go to zero, the kind of singularities you were referring to. If you consider the volume and York time as physical degrees of freedom, you might call that a singularity. But if they're only setting the global scale of the universe once and for all, you might well be able to propagate your solution beyond that. And yes, this is a point we've been making for a long time now. Okay, so this is really technical, and maybe I don't want to go through this. It's just for you who are familiar with constrained systems and Poisson brackets and the Dirac method, the GR and SD have different constraint algebras. And you shouldn't be talking about an algebra in the case of GR, because it's more like an algebraoid. The structure constants are functions on shape space. They change from point to point on shape space. And this is a challenge which shape dynamics doesn't have at all, because these three symmetry gauge constraints of shape dynamics, they just close on each other beautifully. And there are only Lie derivatives here, which are linear in the in your smearing functions. So this thing is just a proper algebra. The one, just a second, let me make this point. The message from this is, for me at least, that a generator associated to refoliation somewhat, the gauge constraint associated to change of your notion of simultaneity of GR, it cannot be interpreted as a gauge transformation on an extended configuration space. It mixes momenta and coordinates on phase space hopelessly. And there is a long list of papers by Kukash and other people who were discussing whether one should apply the straightforward Dirac procedure and consider as observable only the things that are invariant under the action of all the generators. Because things that are invariant under H are also time independent, what Kukash called perennials. So are all our observables in GR completely time independent quantities? And there will be an interesting talk about that today by Philip Hearn, who will make the case that in chaotic systems, trying to look for perennials is meaningless, and therefore canonical quantization schemes don't even make sense. This is a point in favor of shape dynamics, because you have to go to switch to very exotic quantization schemes if you want to do this. And shape dynamics is an alternative that is simpler. Yes, that was before. I'm chairing myself, so this, I don't know, I shouldn't be doing this.
This algebraic property of this GR, is that a general property of all the Hamiltonian versions of GR, or is it?
Any Hamiltonian version of GR.
Is it just specific to ADM
There is only ADM.
Yeah, I mean, which Hamiltonian version?
No, just using another set of canonical variables.
Any theory that's invariant under Hepper-Simsky formations will have an algebraic of the structure. That's general proof. So it doesn't even matter.
It
doesn't have to be GR.
It can be
any
theory.
That was my question.
I don't know.
Yeah, so Ashtekar's variables still have a sort of a problem like that. That's what you're referring to.
It depends, right? Because,
there's this paper by Kukash, Hojman Kukash, titled.
Oh, that's sure. Yeah. But that's in metric variable.
That's in.
What about connection variables?
Says that algebra on the left is unique.
Sure.
But you still have the Hamiltonian constraint and issues like that in connection variables.
It's an algebra. Yeah.
Okay.
They have some axioms, and those axioms lead to the left side.
But I would also go further than what you said. It's not just the issues of finding observables. It's like from the point of view of quantizing the theory canonically, it's the open problem. The one thing that people can't really do and have no really good ideas about how to do. So it's the number one thing.
Yeah, people have been very ingenious in inventing kinematical Hilbert spaces, but the issue is that it's going to the physical one, which is.
So, let me pose a question just to understand the right hand side there. So, suppose there was no mystery. You erase all your previous slides, and you just have Q and P, and somebody throws the S dynamics algebra, pops out of the vacuum, and you have to go make a theory. What would you generate? Suppose you had no history.
Would you recognize it as a gravitational theory?
No. You have nothing.
You have the ST algebra.
You have a Q and P. You have a Diffeo.
Oh, you said you have no X3.
So you have no history.
History, okay.
What do you mean by no history?
No ADM formalism, no 1970s, nothing.
Oh.
And you just have a Q. I just present to you a Q and pi out of the vacuum, maybe a Poisson bracket.
Oh, you may recognize this as
for you, and I make a diffusion generator for you.
This is very kinematical. It contains no dynamics. That's the thing. You would just say, "Oh, this is a scale-free geometry. It's a conformal geometry." So period.
The reason I'm posing the question is then how do you adorn this basic algebra to get what you want?
With a Hamiltonian, which is here.
No, I know. But
yes.
That's coming because you have the history.
Tim is going
exactly.
to talk about this.
Okay.
Via Skype, exactly about this issue.
If he connects, because it's been. Yeah. It's tomorrow anyway.
It's a good question, right?
But
once you have the principle of conformal geometry evolving.
Not even conformal geometry, just that algebra.
Right now, you just have the algebra.
This is really illustrated in this slide. It's
the algebra.
To define your dynamics, you need a Hamiltonian which commutes with everything.
That's
and
right. So
this comes from history.
Yeah. So, but if I don't have the history, then I'm free to invent Hamiltonian, is the point.
Yeah, but can I just
that's
come
right.
in at this point?
That's
if right. you've got that space and you believe in a unique history, then you say, I want my dynamical theory to be such that there's a point and a direction, or a point and a tangent vector in that space leads to a unique solution, a unique history. And that then actually pretty well, in fact, pins it down to something very like GR straight on. In CMC,
but I don't have any of this. So all I have is, I have that algebra. Suppose some mathematician gives you the algebra. Now you can invent any Hamiltonian you like.
No,
I think it's a good question,
yeah.
right? Because you can write down, there's much simpler Hamiltonians.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're local.
Yeah.
And the question is, why is nature pumping out this thing?
So I think spectrum applies also, for instance, particle systems.
Yeah,
right?
It applies to anything.
That's what
sure.
the point is. Forget about geometry
yeah.
for a second. Just apply to the algebra and see what kind of turn.
Well, perhaps, Flavio, you probably want to finish, but I could say a bit more about this later. But I fear we might.
Yes, but just so you know, my position is that you can't, that you need some physical input, and I think it comes from what we know about physics at the moment. If construction principle, it's fair to say it's beyond our reach.
I disagree.
Then you can, look
yeah,
for...
So the only point I want to make is there's an infinite number of gravity theories you can make.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you've got to make some simplifications. I mean, if you have if the kinetic energy is quadratic, for example.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about.
And you look for the simplest potential, then you more or less get GR.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, there is a whole different line of thought here that Henke has been mastering in the last years about considering both symmetries as important. Both. Things and having this property of fixing each other as a fundamental thing, then he can pin down a form of the constraints that more or less I wouldn't say uniquely, but it's very constrained, and that might be a construction principle. Yes,
I know that this, we're really belaboring this point, but I think it's actually really important. And my intuition is that is insights from the quantum theory, because in the quantum theory you need, you might want both a IR and a UV fixed point. And then the question might be, is there a nice way to understand how the requirement of an IR fixed point is going to select out something like this? And I don't have a good argument for that at the moment, but I think, like, looking forward, I think that's a really important question, because there are UV fixed points that seem more natural, but
there's Tim's argument, right?
Tim's,
that the terms that he considered are the
we're having it.
Yeah. So at the end of today, Astrid will try to chair a lively discussion about this.
I hope so.
Anyway, I think I should cut myself off because. This is just to say, you have a Hamiltonian which is conformal invariant, different invariant, and whatever, but it's not local, and it comes out of really what you know about GR. Let's not hide behind a finger. And the degrees of freedom are split into local and global, and the global ones are this volume of your three geometry in some conformal representation, that York time I showed you before, which is the average of expansion that tells you how much the volume is growing, essentially. And these guys are different from the other part, which is the local volume form and the fluctuations of your dilatational momentum, which are local scales, degrees of freedom, and can be engaged however you want. These guys can be the middlemen to on the way to define an Hamiltonian, because you have this functional of the metric and the momentum, which is a solution of this elliptic equation, which Neil has been studying for long, and he knows a lot of things about that, so we hope that it will help us with and this thing is being a that it will morally will contain inverse Laplacians. It's not a non-local thing, and it's average over space. Anyway, we can do some things with this. This is the I will really cut myself off. This is just a nice picture showing that symmetries of GR and shape dynamics really gauge fix each other. They intersect in phase space at a surface, and on that surface or hypersurface, there will be a unique time evolution, an Hamiltonian flow there, and this is where physics takes place. But then you can represent it in different ways in different conformal representations. But yeah, let's not get stuck here. Yes?
I like
that. Yeah, I know you like it. You stole it from me and you put it in all your papers. And you don't even cite me. I mean.
But I asked. But anyways.
Okay, let's.
Yeah, I think it's nice to see here how you can represent a different, different gauge symmetries that can represent the same theory. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the source of this symmetry trait.
So this whole story is that the way you obtain that Hamiltonian and an Hamiltonian flow is that there is still a first class part, but a single global degree of freedom in the refoliation constraint with respect to conformal transformations. And you exploit that to give you that flow. Of course, it's a very non-local statement, and again, yeah, if you believe that physics takes place in three-dimensional conformal geometries, you can represent it however you want, as long as you're intersecting, as you're lifting your scale-free representation from the right point, essentially. But yeah,
yes. So in my discussion session, just putting in an advert. I will discuss some theories that have intersection, but the other sheet is not isotropic. It doesn't correspond to gauge transformations. So there is no refoliation. So there's no dual theory. There's just the shape dynamical theory.
So this will be the discussion on the last slot of the second day.
Yes.
And yeah, okay. So you will have a chance to show this diagram another time. I will conclude here, but just want to give you a caveat. I talked about conformal geometries and beautiful relational things all the time, but then most of the things you're going to see in this workshop are going to be spherically symmetric solutions, asymptotically flat solutions. All of this is very either non-relational or here, in this case, it's trivial. A spherically symmetric tree space is conformally flat. That's a theorem. So it's just a point in your shape space, in your space of physical degrees of freedom.
Somebody sent me an email, I think it was you, and I chickened out.
Mm-hmm.
It's true, but I couldn't do it. Is it easy to do?
Yeah, can you tell us what was the question?
Can you prove that all spherically symmetric spaces are conformally flat?
Locally conformally flat. That's
locally.
The statement. That's easy.
Locally.
Globally, you have to supplement them with boundary conditions. If it's a sphere, you have natural boundary conditions, and you can prove it that it's conformally spherical, not conformally flat. But if you have other boundary conditions, it's not so.
But of course,
clear.
I mean, here what we're thinking about boundary conditions is something like fixed stars or. For instance, if you have a rotating black hole, what is it rotating relative to?
Thank you for spoiling the next slide.
All right, sorry.
No, but true. This is more of a discussion than a normal talk, so it's good. So spherical symmetry, it's just a point in shape space if the topology is that of a sphere. So nothing is happening. There's no change of shapes that you can compare with one to each other, right? If it's asymptotically flat, I told you that only closed space solutions make proper sense. Daniel has been struggling to find a closed space version of his pet solution recently. So asymptotically flat should be a local, I understand it in this way. You have a small region of a much larger closed space, and this region is mostly empty. Maybe there's some stuff at the center, and you can approximate it with asymptotically flat boundary conditions because you don't want to take into full account the detailed dynamics of the rest of the universe. Now, they are kind of trivial or non-relational, but they should be interpreted as backgrounds. That's the message I'm trying to convey. When you will see spherically symmetric and asymptotically flat solutions, you should understand them in this way. This is a toy model of a trivial solution, like spherically symmetric in shape dynamics. It's an n-body system and point particles. And if, for example, they could be interacting with Newton's potential or whatever else you want, if they are they happen to be homothetically falling on top of each other, they all have velocities pointing towards a common center, and this should be a point, really. I recycled an old picture, but if they're pointing towards the center and they have the right velocities, the shape never changes. They must be in what is called a homothetic configuration or Euler configuration in the three-body problem. Yes? Homothetic means that the angles don't change.
The shape
is fixed. So in the next frame, this thing will be just rescaled, but it will be congruent to itself. It will be not congruent. It will be similar to itself. So, for example, in three-body, an equilateral triangle that falls towards the center, never changing its shape. Nothing is happening in shape space here. But how do you understand it? Imagine that this is an n-body problem with Newtonian gravity as the interaction. You can add a pair of particles which are very, very light and very tight, very close to each other. They won't affect the dynamics of this much. They will, but in a certain interval of time, you can approximate the dynamics of the rest with this solution because they're so heavy with respect to the others. This Kepler pair will wander around being influenced by the background solution, but it won't influence it that much. Over a long time, it will accumulate. So it's a bad approximation over very long times, but over an interval, it's good. And you can, now, the only thing that is changing here is the scale of the universe, which is gauge for us. But really, when we still use the scale and talk about it as if it was a physical degree of freedom, what we're really meaning is that you have this Kepler pair. This solution here looks very much like this, but it is not a point in shape space. It's a curve. And the curve mostly wanders around the part of shape space that belongs to the degrees of freedom of this Kepler pair. This Kepler pair can be used as a ruler because it's tight and as a clock because it's very isochronous, but doesn't mean much to say that something is isochronous or congruent in shape space.
If you put in two, there will be. It's mutually.
That's the thing. If you put two, there will be a representation, distinguished representation, so a time-dependent notion of scale, essentially, in which the Kepler pair has always the same semi-major axis, and its period is isochronous. It doesn't change. And in that particular representation, the expansion of the rest of the universe, or the collapse in this case, will essentially solve Newton's equations. It will follow a certain, it will have a certain time dependence, the scale. So when I'm giving you this and I'm saying, the scale goes like t to the two-thirds, it doesn't make any sense in shape space, but I'm really saying, look, if I added some real shape degrees of freedom, which are light, and I went to this representation in which they are more simply described, I would see that time dependence of the scale of the universe, these sort of things. Okay, you want to add something?
I was about to, can you go back one slide? I wanted to interject. I wanted to fill in for Lee because he had but now he's here, so maybe he can fill in for himself. Because we were discussing this this issue of syntactically flat and solutions with high degrees of symmetries. And he pointed out that there's this conflict has also been there in GR from the start, that GR is really a theory of space and time in which it only makes sense when there are no symmetries, because then you can actually distinguish space-time points. Mm-hmm. And if you have high degrees of symmetries, you're basically reducing the dimensionality of space. So if you have spherical symmetry, you have 1 plus 1. But to make it tractable, you have to be able to simplify, otherwise...
Here's the thing that in GR we have, but we don't really have in pure shape dynamics. I don't know if we need it or not, but like in GR you have the geodesic principle, right? So if you have a background and then you have something in your head, right, a tool in your head that says if I sprinkle test particles onto this geometry, then they're going to kind of flow a certain way. They're going to go along geodesics, and so then you look at the geodesics of these things.
I think we have an analog thing.
Well, we have.
You give me a conformal three geometry evolving in time, mm-hmm. then I solve this equation, which is conformally covariant, and I can give you a scale factor. That gives me a local notion of scale. Then I solve the conjugate equation, the one regarding the lapse. We call it lapse fixing equation. That gives me a proper time at each point. If I put them together, I can reconstruct a four metric, and that is a background over which light non-back reacting degrees of freedom would propagate along geodesics, for example, and all that. It's just more complicated, but the thing is, everything is contained in the conformal geometry, and you can construct a useful notion of scale and time that...
The geodesic principle can be derived by equations of motion.
Yes.
You can...
That's what I was going to say.
But you need an energy condition, so...
Yes.
Not purely from one sense. Can you get the geodesic?
Well, you need to couple it with...
And you need to assume...
Yeah, okay, minimal coupling. Yeah. Yes.
You want to have something completely
true. In fact, I'm going to conclude. Okay, so I was planning to give you an overview of the various talks, but maybe I'll spread it through the rest of the workshop. And this is just to say that now we're going to have... three talks, actually, three talks about the work that we have been doing these days on black holes, because Hickey, not long ago, by requiring continuity of the three-dimensional conformal geometry, found the analog of Schwarzschild solution in shape dynamics, and it doesn't look like exactly like Schwarzschild. It looks more like a wormhole, because you only taking the two of the four quadrants that you have in the Kruskal extension of Schwarzschild. And this is very exciting, but it has some shortcomings. He assumed something regarding the gauge degrees of freedom, the shift in particular. And if you take it at face value, it has, it either predicts closed time-like curves, or which are represented in this nice cartoon, or it predicts an infinite amount of copies of the same space-time region repeating itself. So this can be solved by considering the formation of a black hole, so how matter collapses and leaves behind it something like a black hole. And this is what we've been working on in the last year. Andrea will talk about this, the gravitational collapse. After him, we will have a coffee break, and then Hamish will talk about his work with Sean in comparing the shape dynamical and the GR description of this sort of things. And then there is, I just wanted to show this picture because it's the wormhole solution that Hickey found has this property of inversion symmetry. So there is a sort of horizon, and the points inside are mapped to the points outside, so that the center is mapped to infinity and the horizon to itself. I think that Gabriel, if I interpreted right, his recent work, he's been trying to define horizons in this way, as surfaces of, around which parity, which are invariant under this parity. So I think I will leave the stage now to Andrea, if you don't have any further questions. I'm sharing myself, actually. Oh, here you are.